With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we'll have this week's Almond Update with Brian German. But our top story today, California is among four states that this week joined the Department of Justice civil antitrust lawsuit against AgriStats. The suit alleges that AgriStats organized and managed anti-competitive information exchanges among broiler chicken, pork, and turkey processors. The attorneys general of California, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Tennessee joined the effort. The Justice Department filed the lawsuit in September of this year, alleging AgriStats violated Section 1 of the Sherman Act. The complaint alleges that AgriStats' scheme continues to this day in the chicken processing industry, among others. While AgriStats paused its turkey and pork reporting after facing several private antitrust lawsuits, AgriStats has expressed an intent to resume such reports following the lawsuits. A statement at the time of filing by AgriStats says the lawsuit threatens serious harm to American consumers of chicken, pork, and turkey because protein producers depend on AgriStats reports to help them identify opportunities to reduce production costs to keep prices low. In other news, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack talked with Western governors about USDA and U.S. Forest Service efforts to curb wildfire activity. Rod Bain has more.
A visit with Western State Governors Tuesday by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Among the topics of discussion during the Western Governors Association meeting in Wyoming, the Western wildfire crisis, and USDA efforts to combat increased wildfire activity.
I want to assure you that we remain committed to our wildfire crisis strategy. I'm pleased to note that in our first year of operation in fiscal year 22, we did about 3.2 million acres of treatment. Our last fiscal year that just ended in September of this year, we increased that to 4.2 million acres, so a million acre increase. We're looking at primary fire sheds, which we know create great risk. We think the work that we're doing is helping to protect 550 communities, 1,800 watersheds, and 2,500 miles of power lines that are so important to the resiliency and the effectiveness and economic opportunity in Western states.
The secretary adds expansion of such work, as well as reforestation efforts, also remain a priority. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The West could soon be getting more precipitation. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at a potential cold weather system traveling through the West next week and what that means precipitation-wise.
This west-east storm track pattern that we've been experiencing over the last couple of weeks, that is going to break down all of a sudden early next week. And with that, we'll see a pretty strong push of cold air arriving from western North America, working its way down into the western United States. Nothing dramatic or extreme, but certainly notably colder in the western United States, mainly west of the Rockies. That will occur about a week from now. And with that, there's going to be quite a bit of Pacific storminess moving ashore too. So that certainly means significant snow developing by mid-November across many of the high elevation areas of the West. We've already started to establish some snowpack in the Cascades and the Northern Rockies, but for a lot of the remainder of the West, we have just either very light snow on the ground in the high elevations or no snow at all in the Southwest. So that will change as the colder air and stormier weather arrives in mid-November. We will start establishing these Western high elevation snowpacks. Obviously, that's the key for water supply next spring. So we'll be keeping an eye on that.
In other news, the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer rose 4 points in October to 110. The modest improvement in farmer sentiment resulted from farmers' improved perspective on current conditions on their farms, as well as their expectations for the future. The index of current conditions rose 3 points to 101, while the index of future expectations rose 5 points to 114. Farmers in this month's survey were a bit less concerned about the risk of lower prices for crops and livestock and felt somewhat better about their farm's financial situation than a month earlier, although that did not translate into a more favorable investment outlook among survey respondents. Farmers remained cautiously optimistic about farmland values, particularly when asked to look ahead 5 years. Nearly one in four farmers responding to the survey reported making changes in their farm operations in response to long-term weather pattern changes. Changes implemented by farmers were wide-ranging, and some reported making multiple changes in response to shifting weather patterns. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. In today's National Spotlight, a new announcement leads to changes in fertilizer tariffs, but a senator hopes for a bit more. David Geiger has this report.
With harvest wrapping up, farmers are looking at next year as attention turns to that upcoming crop. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says inflation is eating into the bottom line of farmers. Adding to that are record price increases in fertilizer. Grassley hopes to change that. He's written to the Department of Commerce for years asking for reduced tariffs on Moroccan phosphate.
The United States company has 82% of the market. So why do they need protection from Morocco phosphate? It doesn't make sense to me. So we continue to send letters.
From 2020 to 2022, phosphate fertilizer prices have increased 230%. And while senators and representatives continue to send letters on the subject, Grassley did not anticipate much action. But the department announced after an administrative review, it will lower tariffs on phosphate.
The Commerce Department announced it is lowering tariffs on Moroccan phosphate from 20% to 2%. That's another shock that it was such a big reduction.
Grassley calls it obvious positive news for farmers because of increased competition.
Because there'll be more competition to the American company that has 82% of the market, ought to get the price down. And hopefully it does.
The Iowa Corn Growers Association is pushing for the next farm bill for improved competition and transparency in the fertilizer industry, including a mandate for the USDA to assess pricing practices used by fertilizer companies and the effects of the price increase on both farmers and consumers. Grassley is in support.
I intend to introduce legislation that mandates a comprehensive study of fertilizer industry by the Department of Agriculture.
As of 2018, the USDA's Economic Research Service says 79% of U.S. corn acres and 42% of soybean acres use phosphate fertilizer. About 300 million acres in total uses some type of phosphorus. And 2015 data shows the nation used 7.8 million short tons of phosphate. I'm David Geiger.
USDA recently concluded an agricultural trade mission to Southeast Asia. Gary Crawford has details.
If you are in Singapore or in that part of Southeast Asia and you turn on your radio, you might hear this song. It's been a big hit there. Also, it seems U.S. food and agricultural products are a hit there, too, and could become an even bigger hit over the next few years.
We are at the end of our week-long trade mission to Southeast Asia.
Under Secretary of Agriculture for Trade, Alexis Taylor led the mission focusing on Malaysia and Singapore, but the almost 30 representatives of U.S. food and ag businesses met with potential buyers from other nations in the region. In fact,
we've had over 300 business-to-business meetings, but I think more impactful is the quality of those meetings, the interest of the buyers that I heard from our businesses.
Also, taking part in this trade mission and in many of those meetings, California's Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross.
The quality of the meetings were outstanding for all of our people, and that's what I always take back with me. But for me, it was sitting in the sessions that were arranged to better understand from food manufacturers as well as trade associations here, the importers, the retailers, the importance of showing up, of building the relationship, and to be committed, that we have to start small and grow. And I think our companies are ready to do that, but they want to know that we're going to be here for the long term. And I really appreciate that.
Alexis Taylor says there are good reasons why USDA picked Southeast Asia for a trade mission first.
The just population dynamics that we are seeing, they have a growing middle class. There is strong connection to the United States, a preference for U.S. food and agricultural products, which makes this a very attractive market.
But a word of caution here. She says, yes, Southeast Asia is a very new and emerging market for U.S. food and agricultural sellers. But, of course,
if they are new and emerging markets for us, they are for others in the world as well. And our competitors are here, and they're showing up, and they're working on building these relationships as well. And so we need to be equally as aggressive.
Right now, Southeast Asia is a pretty exciting $15 billion market for U.S. food and farm products.
It's going to be an even more exciting market for U.S. food and agriculture in 5 years.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, the National Pork Producers Council is cautioning FDA on antimicrobial use data proposal. They submitted comments on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's draft proposal for collecting and analyzing data on antimicrobial use in food-producing animals. The FDA wants a framework for establishing a public-private partnership to gather the data used to foster antimicrobial stewardship and slow the development of antimicrobial resistance, which can lead to treatment failures in humans. Now, why this really matters to MPPC is that antimicrobial products are used to maintain animal health and well-being and to produce safe food. They note that producers and veterinarians collect data to help them make informed decisions on appropriate interventions and treatments. MPPC strongly supports antimicrobial stewardship and the production of safe, wholesome protein for consumers. So in its comments to the FDA, MPPC cautioned the agency not to rely on antibiotic use data to establish causality for the antimicrobial resistance in human illnesses. MPPC also expressed opposition to antimicrobial performance standards, which could negatively affect the animal health and welfare, and urged the agency to protect data privacy. If you'd like to learn more about this, just simply go to the National Pork Producers Council website, nppc.org. Well, the American Angus Association is excited to offer internship opportunities for students by a trial run of potential career choices. The association has 5 internship positions available for the summer of 2024. It's a 10-week program designed to provide an immersive, hands-on experience and help students to grow professionally as they dip their toes into the workforce. The 5 internships are being offered in marketing, publications, communications, events, junior activities, and Angus Genetics Incorporated. According to Brooklyn Botterman, 2023 events and junior activities intern, what makes an internship at Angus so unique is that the Angus family believes in your ability to achieve a level of high success from day one. Now, students who want to apply should submit their resume, cover letter, and references by December the 1st of this year. For more information about this opportunity, go to angus.org. And to note, the 107th Annual California Cattlemen's and Cattlewomen's Convention is coming up November 29th through December 1st at the Nugget Casino in Reno, Nevada. Full registration for members is only $275. That includes all events with the exception of the Cowbell of the Year lunch and the CCA-CCW Awards Banquet. But those tickets can be purchased separately. Full registration for non-members is $325. Confirmed speakers for this year's event include Patrick Linnell with Cattle Facts, Michelle Miller, the Farm Babe, and Emily Ellis with the Animal Ag Alliance. A full schedule and more can be found on their website, calcattleman.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I am Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report. But first, we have more of the day's agriculture news with today's AgNet West headlines. Here's Brian German.
The recent agricultural trade mission to Southeast Asia appears to have been a success. On a press call from Singapore, USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor described the value of the markets in Southeast Asia.
One of the things I wanted to highlight, I think, this morning is just the quality of real meetings I know our business has had this week. We've had over 300 business-to-business meetings, but I think more impactful is the quality of those meetings, the interest of the buyers that I heard from our businesses on. In Southeast Asia, there are one of the reasons we focus trade mission here and or continue to focus some of our trade missions here. Last year, some of you may recall we were in the Philippines. Is the just population dynamics that we are seeing. They have a growing middle class. There is strong connection to the United States, a preference for U.S. food and agricultural products. There is a lot of trust in our quality, safety, reliability as a trading partner, which makes this a very attractive market or set of markets. In the Southeast Asia region, we export approximately $15 billion worth of food and agricultural products last year. And we are excited to continue to really invest in this region and our trading partners here.
The Pacific Coast Coalition Dairy Business Innovation Initiation has secured a $1.8 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The funding announcement marks the 4th award under the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives Grant Program. With nearly $1 million dedicated to dairy business grants, the initiative aims to support small and mid-sized dairy businesses in California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, New Mexico, and Arizona. The funding announced at the World Dairy Expo will be available for dairy product development, production, marketing, and distribution projects. Online applications will become available on January 2nd, 2024. The total dairy processing-related grants through the program now exceed $25.3 million over the past 3 years. Collaborating with several different universities, the initiative will allocate portions of the funding for workforce development, student preparation, conferences, and e-learning materials. The program also emphasizes industry training, including bilingual support for Spanish-speaking workers and entrepreneurs. A significant portion of byproducts are being used in California dairy rations. Cooperative Extension Dairy Farm Advisor Jennifer Heggie said their survey results from dairy nutritionists demonstrated a huge range in percentages when it comes to byproducts in rations.
So we still have dairies in the state that aren't feeding byproducts. And so that range went from zero up to 80%. So we did have some nutritionists reporting that in their highest fed herds, 80% of the ration is coming from byproducts, which obviously is just a tremendously high number. When I took the responses and weighted those nutritionists, when I asked them for their average inclusion rate and I weighted it by the number of cows that they feed in the state, we came up with that weighted average of byproduct inclusion rates of 41%. So 41% of the lactating cow ration on average in California is actually coming from those byproducts.
USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service has launched a tool to detail how recent trade actions have helped agricultural producers, businesses, and industries succeed. The online resource breaks down ag trade by individual state. For California, the online story map explains that more than $24.3 billion worth of agricultural products were exported in 2021. One of the trade wins that's detailed is India's removal of retaliatory tariffs on agricultural products, including chickpeas, lentils, almonds, walnuts, and apples. USDA estimates that by 2024, U.S. almond exports to India could reach $1 billion, while walnuts may reach a record $70 million, and U.S. apple exports may grow tenfold to between $50 and $80 million in 2024. Another important trade win for California is USDA's partnering with the Wine Institute to promote 70 wines from California through a buyer's mission. In 2020-2021, Hong Kong was the fourth largest export destination for U.S. wine. The online tool can be found by searching Foreign Agricultural Service Story Maps. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
And don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Two new mobile apps are streamlining the way farmers connect with their retailers to stay supplied and keep their operations running smoothly. Matt Merritt shares more.
I'm here today with Stephen Valenson, CEO of Growers, to talk about the new releases named Growers and Growers Retail that just went live October 30th. Stephen, can you give us some details about this new technology?
So the two platforms, farmers use the Growers application and they use it to search for, discover, and request products from their local retailers. And then the Growers Retail application is, of course, used by retailers to respond to those requests and provide feedback and advice and recommendations to farmers that are engaging with them in that way.
Farmers and ag retailers face all sorts of challenges, and that's what typically prompts these improvements in technology. What sort of challenges did you recognize that led you to develop Growers and Growers Retail?
On the farmer side, there is no cohesive single source of truth for them to do research and discovery on new products and how they should or could be used in their existing agronomic programs. It's difficult to Google those solutions. So we put that into a platform that enables them not only to research and discover those products, but also be connected with their local retailers that can provide them and sell them. On the retail side, more and more farmers are embracing technology to manage and run their business. Retail needs to have an answer on how they can address this growing segment of the market and engage with them in the way that they want to be serviced, which is in a digital way, in a more efficient way, and still maintain that relationship. And that's precisely what Growers Retail does.
Meeting these challenges has an impact on the bottom line for farmers and retailers, right? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, for Growers Retail, it's a very simple equation in that access to this platform and the farmers that are using this platform gives them a more efficient, cost-effective way to serve existing customers as well as acquire new ones. So lowering their customer acquisition costs and increasing the amount of farmers that one salesperson can service, it creates, you know, exponential ROI. From a farmer standpoint, a lot of the bottom line impact is done in just the efficiency and convenience of organizing their entire input procurement process in one application where all of their records, all of their purchase history can be consolidated in one spot and then exported and reported on for many other purposes.
I understand maintaining the relationships between farmers and retailers was a focus for growers when developing these products. How do these apps navigate that issue?
Traditionally, digital tools have threatened the relationship, not really enabled them. We see this across all industries. And so it was something that we were hyper-focused on when we developed this application. And we feel quite proud that we've enabled an environment where both retailers and farmers, as well as manufacturers, are supported in a way where nobody is disrupted. In fact, there's immense value created for all three parties because it's a collaborative ecosystem where manufacturers can support retailers, retailers can support farmers, and farmers ultimately get the value that they need and deserve from their partners in the agribusiness space.
What if a farmer doesn't work with a retailer who's in your network of partners? Can they still use this technology?
Absolutely. In fact, there's a really convenient solution built into the application where if a farmer wants to request products from the local retailer and they do not see them in the platform, they can actually send an invite directly to their sales agronomist from within inside the platform to complete that loop. They can also get access and see and understand what other retailers and product providers are in their area that may have the products that they need.
Is there anything you'd like to add that we missed today?
I want to emphasize the point that what we've delivered to the market is really transformational in the way that farmers and retailers do business, right? We're moving into the 21st century. Technology is definitely going to be more of a bigger picture in how farmers do their business today and 5 years from now. And I feel proud that we finally delivered a solution to the market that brings that efficiency and ease of use that farmers demand and deserve, and does it in a way that actually supports and even enhances the customer experience that retailers can provide to the farmers that they serve.
Well, thank you, Stephen. If you'd like to learn more about growers and growers retail, visit their website at growers.ag.
I'm Matt Merritt reporting.
There's a boom for butterfat. Find out why coming up on This Land of Ours. The long-term demand trends for dairy products indicate butter, cheese, and other full-fat dairy foods will continue to grow in sales and volume for the foreseeable future. U.S. consumers have shifted away from margarine and reduced-fat dairy foods over the last decade as nutritional science surrounding saturated fats has evolved. As a result, butterfat levels in the national milk supply have risen sharply in response to changing demand patterns and dairy market dynamics. According to a new report from Cobank's Knowledge Exchange, the butterfat boom will continue as the entire dairy supply chain is capturing additional value from milk with higher fat and protein levels. Cobank's Corey Geiger says despite the significant growth in domestic butterfat production over the last decade, there's still tremendous upside potential, largely because the U.S. remains a milk fat deficit nation. Geiger says the overall market picture for butterfat is quite clear, with tremendous growth potential both domestically and ultimately via the export market. It's time to start thinking turkey. You've just found a turkey that's been in your freezer for years. Well, is it still okay to eat that turkey? Gary Crawford has an answer from an expert.
Let's go back to the year 2013. The place? Ooh, very cold Siberia. Scientists discover frozen in the ice a prehistoric specimen of Mammuthus primigenius, i.e. a woolly mammoth, and this thing is pretty much intact. Researchers even find liquid blood in this well-preserved mastodon, which had been trapped in the ice for only about 39,000 years. Fast forward to this week. The place? The cold wasteland of your deep freeze, which mimics the climate of the place where the woolly mammoth was found. You're doing an archaeological dig into the bottommost depths, and you discover a perfectly preserved specimen of Meligrius galopevo. Yes, a frozen turkey, apparently undisturbed for years. Has this ever happened to you or somebody that you know?
Yes.
This is Meredith Carruthers, a food safety expert with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. And indeed, Meredith says they do get quite a few calls this time of year from people who have unearthed ancient turkeys in their freezers. They want to know, is this thing still safe to eat? And Meredith, what's the answer?
It's definitely safe to have a turkey in the freezer because foodborne illness bacteria don't grow in the freezer. So no matter how long something is frozen, it will remain safe. The only thing that changes is the quality might diminish the longer that it's frozen for. But, your year-old, two-year-old turkey that might be in the freezer that you stuck in there and forgot about is definitely still going to be safe as long as it has been frozen that entire time.
Year or 2 years. Sometimes these birds are in there for longer than 2 years, right, Meredith?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So as a quiz for our listeners, both of them, what do you think as far as calls to the hotline? What's the record for the length of time a turkey has been frozen, then unearthed and prepared? 2 years, five, three, 10 years? And the answer is, Meredith?
The record that we have gotten from our hotline calls is somebody was trying to use a five-year-old turkey that had been frozen for that long.
Whoa, 5 years, that's a long time. And would that still be safe?
We told them as long as you haven't had any major power outages and it's been frozen that entire time, it is in fact safe to use.
You know, I wonder if that caller with the five-year turkey actually did cook it and eat it.
Yes, they called us back and told us that it was super tasty and still just as delicious, which is incredible considering, like I said, sometimes the quality is what's going to diminish the longer that something is frozen.
So your results may vary. Now, for answers to all of your holiday food safety and preparation questions, you can call the folks at the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or go online to ask.usda.gov, ask.usda.gov. The experts will be working even on Thanksgiving Day from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Brian German joins us with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Today's segment features a conversation between ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Relations, Rebecca Bailey, and ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications, Taylor Hillman.
Rebecca, we're talking today about the Almond Leadership Program. For those who don't know what the Almond Leadership Program is, tell us a little bit about what the program is.
Yeah, so the Almond Leadership Program started in 2009. And initially, the main purpose was to be a year-long program that industry members would apply to be a part of. And throughout the year, these industry members would go to various seminars. So one seminar per month, where they would have the opportunity to interact with Almond Board staff and other leaders and experts within the industry and gain a real understanding of all of the different program areas within the Almond Board and how they all work together to serve, you know, at the end of the day, growers and processors in the state. And then with the hope that these industry leaders truly serve on our committees and board in the long run. So not only are they gaining that total view of the almond board and the almond industry as a whole, but hopefully taking what they've learned throughout the program and really using that to be a leader within the industry or within their own community.
And we're starting to see that as we looked at the committee members and board members recently. We did a tally of that, and we are seeing that that is happening. In fact, someone goes through the Almond Leadership Program and then ends up taking a leadership role at ABC, which is fantastic. How long has the program been going on? Again, for those who aren't familiar with it, this has been going on for a little while.
Yeah, so the program was established in 2009, and we are currently on the 13th class. So just over a decade, and it's definitely grown and has become, you know, much more noticeable throughout the industry over those years.
One of the cool things about the program is that there are participants and then there are mentors. And it's kind of nice to have not only the participant-to-participant experience, but also what they learn from the mentor, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. That's honestly one of my favorite components of the program. Each participant is paired with a mentor, and the mentors are typically a little further along in their career within the almond industry or have served on a committee or the board or have been a former Almond Leadership Program participant. So it's really a cool relationship and bond that you get to see forming between the participant and the mentor throughout the year. They're required to meet quarterly. Mentors are also invited to all of the seminars. So even if you're paired with a specific mentor, you can still get to know all of the other mentors in the class. So it's really a great opportunity for the class members to have that experience and that interaction with those members in the industry.
What kind of industry members can apply for the Allman Leadership Program? Is this open to anybody?
It is open to anyone within the state of California, of course, and of course have to be tied in some way, shape, or form to the almond industry. So it's not just for growers, it's not just for processors. Although that's typically a large makeup of the class, we see lots of members who work kind of on the crop input side. We've had beekeepers, we've had people who work in ag finance. So it's really open to the general industry. You just have to be tied to almonds in some way.
Is it a competitive process? You say the application period is open. How many applications do we normally get? And is it a pretty competitive process to pick the participants each year?
Yeah, that's another thing. Over the years, it's been really exciting to see the increase in applications year to year. So on average, I would say we have about 50 people apply for this program each year, which is awesome. Of that, we will typically select about an 18-member class for the year. So it is highly competitive. Each and every year, the pool of applicants the caliber just increases each year, which is really awesome to see and really hopeful for the future of the industry as well.
Aside from the experience and everything they learn from going in the field and seeing different parts of the almond industry and learning about the Almond Board of California as well, one of the cool things that this program does is they do an incredible job at fundraising for California FFA, right? This is something it's an added benefit to the program of you can put your name and feel good about something where you're raising a good chunk of money that goes toward ag education.
Yeah, this has been kind of a newer component that's been added over the years, is having this kind of more of a community service component of raising money for the California FFA Foundation. Typically, each year, the class, they have the opportunity to come up with what they want that fundraiser to be or how they go about that. The past handful of years, they've done a golf tournament, which has really just been a huge highlight for the industry. And it's really a great opportunity for the class members to just engage with one another, kind of do something outside of the walls of the Almond Board and be able to do outreach within their own community and with different industry members that they know. And typically they're asked to raise $25,000 for FFA. That's the goal that the class has. And they always seem to go above and beyond that amount, which is just super awesome.
One of the aspects of the program is special projects. Every participant works on a special project for the entire year, right? This is something that they are able to kind of brainstorm some ideas and come up with.
Yeah, that's correct. There's a couple assignments that class members have to do throughout their time in the leadership program. One of those is the special project, and that is something that they have essentially about 10 months to do. They pick their idea or their topic area kind of at the start of the program, typically in February, and it concludes in October. And then at the final seminar in November, they all present on their special projects. The class and the mentors vote, and the winner gets to present at the Almond Conference on the Almond stage. And the special project is really something that they get to choose on their own. Typically, it's something that they're passionate about or something that they want to learn more about within the industry. Some folks go very research heavy, and you can see them doing field trials. Others do something maybe a little more of a creative component type of a project, but it's really meant to be something that they can take and run with and work on throughout the year.
Yeah, some of those projects have been very interesting. And also one of the other cool things about the program is talk about that hands-on experience. Job shadowing is a pretty cool part of this program.
Yeah, this is a really awesome component that I think often gets overlooked. Each participant has the opportunity to job shadow one person throughout the course of the year. They have all year to work on this, and it's truly just a one-day job shadow. It has to be someone within the almond industry, but someone who is outside of their area of expertise. And this is meant to, again, just encourage that networking and getting to know someone else, as well as getting to know a more comprehensive overview of the industry and how those different roles work together.
Okay, well, as we mentioned, applications are open. How can people apply?
So applications are open now through Friday, December 8th, and you can go online, go to almonds.com/almond leadership program. There's an application down there, and it's a pretty easy, convenient process to apply. So make sure you get those applications in by Friday, December 8th.
Thank you, Brian. This is the AgNet NewsHour. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and now for more news. Recent data from the Department of Agriculture provides an update on foreign investment in U.S. agricultural lands. Michael Clements shares more.
USDA's latest report on foreign-owned farmland in the United States shows foreign investors own less than 2% of all land in the country. Danny Munch, American Farm Bureau Federation economist, says foreign owners of farmland are required to report their investments by the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act.
USDA publishes the results from those reports from the 2 years prior. So the most recent data we have is 2021 data. In 2021, 40 million acres, or 3.1% of all privately held agricultural land, was owned by foreign investors.
Munch says Canadian investors own the largest portion of foreign-held U.S. farmland,
with almost a third of that, or 0.97% of all U.S. ag land. Following Canada, investors from the Netherlands own 0.37% of U.S. ag land, Italy 0.21%, the United Kingdom 0.19%, and Germany 0.17%. Those five countries make up over half of all U.S. ag land owned by foreign investors.
While a lot of attention regarding foreign-owned farmland is focused on China, the country ranks 18th with 0.03% of foreign investor-held land.
A way to look at this is about the size of a single average-sized county in Ohio. Almost half of all foreign-owned ag land in the United States is timberland. In states like Maine, Michigan, Alabama, and Louisiana, over 85% of their foreign-owned ag land is all forest land. And when we look at the types of companies, the leading investors are timber and paper companies and renewable energy companies investing in land for solar and wind projects.
Learn more on the market intel page at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
There's a new tractor coming to market, and you won't be taking a look under the hood. That's because the hood doesn't open. And if it did, there's not much to see, just batteries and an electric motor. This is just one of the differences between your traditional diesel utility tractor and the industry's first all-electric utility tractor with autonomous features. It's the T4 Electric Power by New Holland. It's coming out in 2024. Leah Bioni is the product marketing manager. She tells us where and on what farms this type of technology will work best. But first, she describes the sentiment of farmers for an all-electric machine.
It definitely depends on the farmer of where they're at and how their infrastructure and if they're prepared or even able to run an electric vehicle on the farm. We're seeing a high demand from specialty agriculture on the West Coast. They have an immense amount of subsidies and funds available to them to supply alternative fuel sources on their farm. We're also seeing a lot of municipalities that are very interested in the technology, as well as some mixed farm and equine operations as well. It's a tractor of their size, and they really like the idea of being more energy independent and also that reduced cost of ownership.
The rollout is starting primarily on the West Coast due to the large demand for alternative energy sources. Bioni says the region has state and federal subsidies available to offset the cost of both the tractor and the charging infrastructure. That's today's top news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.